WBZH 910 AM, W245 CT Hayward, and always streaming on the Civic Media app.
ABC News, I'm Richard Cantu. Poland's leader looking for negotiations on ending the Russia-Ukraine hostilities to begin relatively soon.
Polish Prime Minister Donald Tusk saying peace talks on the war in Ukraine could possibly start this winter. Poland has been one of Kyiv's staunchest supporters since Russia's 2022 invasion of Ukraine. Tusk said Warsaw would aim to be heavily involved in any peace talks when it takes up the European Union's rotating presidency on January 1st.
ABC's
De La Quaterai, ABC News.
A fast-growing wildfire in Malibu, California. It's pushing 2,900 acres burned, 20,000 residents either under evacuation orders or warnings. Containment of the blaze still at 0%. A bipartisan congressional task force is making recommendations after two attempts on now President-elect Trump's life. The panel recommending the agency protect fewer foreign leaders during the height of election season here. This is ABC News.
I'm James Kelly with WBZH News. Your news roundup in quick podcast form. Find it anytime on the WBZH website at buzzofthenorth.com.
The Badgers losing their quarterback. Hi, I'm Mike Clemens with sports. College football, the Badgers' starting quarterback, Tyler Van Dyke, has announced he's entered the transfer portal. Van Dyke suffered a torn ACL in his right knee, week three, ending his season. He was replaced by Braden Locke. Wisconsin has hired a new offensive coordinator, 58-year-old Jeff Grimes, most recently with Kansas. NBA, the Bucks host the Magic tonight in Milwaukee. It's an NBA Cup quarterfinal game. Major League Baseball meetings underway in Dallas. The Brewers say that Christian Yelich, making progress from his back surgery. Manager Pat Murphy on shortstop Willie Adames leaving the team in free agency after signing with the Giants.
Willie, the guy can play, man. You want the ball hit to him in a big situation. You want him at the plate. He plays every day, and you want him up in every big situation. He's proven it time and time again. That's who he is. He loves it. He revels in it. I mean, we've lost a lot. We lost Burns. We lost Hader in the recent years. But losing this guy, woo.
That's Brewers manager Pat Murphy. With sports, I'm Mike Clemens.
Ho-ho, the holidays are here, and it's time to pick a present from the grown-up gift list with Civic Media's statewide text-to-win contest. Listen while you work for the keywords to text for your chance to win $100 cash, an overnight vacation at Chula Vista Resort, and be entered to win one of the grand prizes, a robot vacuum, new luggage, humidifier, espresso machine, and more on the grown-up gift list at civicmedia.us. Just download the Civic Media app and listen weekdays at 7, 11, 1, and 4 for your chance to win in the statewide contest. Ho-ho-ho!
You're listening to the Buzz of the North, WBZH, Hayward's home for Up North News Radio.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
It's time for the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is the voice of the working class, Rick Smith.
And welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks so much for being here. Today on the big program, lots to get to, lots to talk about. Yesterday on the program, talked a little bit about China. China wanting to dominate the globe, wanting to be the manufacturer of the globe, wanting to dominate every sector, industry, the whole nine yards, and what I thought the Trump administration should do to maybe not put us in that situation. And I got a lot of response from people, most of it very positive, saying, look, you know, we do need to reshore manufacturing. We need to produce things again for not only our national security, but also for an economy that works for people. But I did get some emails from people who were, you know, a little less on my side. And I wanted to read one of them. Lewis is a guy who's emailed me a number of times on this and has, you know, explained, you know, his position, a disabled military veteran, a Vietnam veteran. And look, I respect his service. I respect his opinion. And so I wanted to read the email and maybe go through it a little bit. He says, Dear Rick, I see, well, you're at it again, blaming China's government for something that was done by corporate America. Look, I've never not blamed corporate America. It was our corporations who outsourced their manufacturing to Chinese-owned factories by way of subcontractors. He says American corporations are not allowed to own factories in China for the same reason that Chinese corporations are not allowed to own factories here. That's not accurate. They are allowed. They do own factories here. So the Chinese factories, he says, in China operate while only turning at best a 5% profit for manufactured products to be retailed in the U.S., where American corporations are making a profit of 175%. Not sure where that's coming from. Haven't seen the numbers. Wasn't cited. But he goes into, instead of tariffs on Chinese goods, we should be putting tariffs on American corporate profits. He's not wrong about the corporate profits. He says for 95% of workers in China, there's no such thing as an income tax. For most of their taxes are levied on corporations and the incomes of executives. He says that he lived in China for 5 months with his wife, who is from there, and that she's shocked that there's a minimum wage, that a minimum wage worker has taxes withheld from their paychecks here and then must file an income tax return. She works in a Chinese market here for minimum wages, he says. He only lived in China for a month, and he figured out that 95% of what he had learned in China from U.S. sources were pure fiction. He said, I never saw an armed police person in China. Their medical care is vastly better than ours. After we were married, my wife got sick and told me that she must go to the ER. I had pictures in my head of what a horror story that would be, considering the numbers of people and how crowded that it would be after having been to ERs here. He said, we arrived at the hospital and the charges were 25 yuan, $4.25 for a routine SLIP, I would assume trip to the ER. He said, we walked into the ER and it was empty with three bored nurses waiting to be served for service. She was then seen by a doctor, immediately examined, diagnosed, prescribed, and we were sent in the hospital pharmacy. We were in and out the door in less than an hour with medicine in hand and cost of $4.25 an hour. He says, I'm 100% disabled veteran and I have to fight tooth and nail with the VA just to get mediocre health care. Compared to China, this country is embarrassing in many ways. And look, I feel Lewis's pain. I really do. I don't know that a lot of what he's thrown out there is accurate, especially the numbers on the profit side. But we should be taxing corporations at a much higher rate. And I do blame corporate America for all of the things that are going wrong. The reason that was the pipeline over there. I have never not. But I do have a question. If it is this utopia of which you speak, why aren't you there? Why aren't people from other countries rushing to get there? See, this is where the proof is in the pudding. We don't see mass immigration there. We don't see people saying, hey, you got free stuff, let's go. Or you've got reasonable stuff. It's this utopia. Look, we've got problems in this country. And Lewis, I feel your anger. It's real. It's justified, like millions of others in this country. And I hope that this issue, and the reason I talk about this issue so much, is I think this is a unifying opportunity to say, look, we want to manufacture things here. If not simply to provide jobs for communities and for provide an economic engine to raise families and have good schools and good neighborhoods and all of the things that we want, well, for national security, for prosperity, for a whole bunch of reasons. The reality is we have tried this experiment. Lots of bad politicians, lots of bad CEOs, and let's not forget consumers hooked on cheap junk. We've got a lot of responsibility here. But ultimately, I don't know that I'm buying the everything's great there. Because the stories that I hear, the stories that keep coming back to me, aren't utopia. In fact, kind of hellish. Now, what I hope is taken from this, what I hope we learn in this country, is that people like you, Lewis, are struggling. People all across this country are in need of help. And I hope our politicians on both sides, this is not a red hat, blue hat, green hat. This is a political issue for me. It's an all political issue. And the hope is that people understand that the anger is real, it's justified, and it's got to be addressed. So thank you, Lewis, for the email. Thank you for your words, and I look forward to hearing from you again. Anyone else, if you've got, look, we got a bunch of responses on this. You got thoughts, I want to hear it. Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. I do answer all emails. I use one or two of them occasionally here on the show. Want to hear your thoughts, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Quick break, back with Scott Paul.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So, Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau said that Canada will, in fact, respond if Donald Trump imposes new tariffs on Canada, arguing that retaliatory tariffs were successful when Trump put them on back in 2018, and, you know, saying, look, you know, we're going to respond. Because they weren't great for us, and look, am I surprised? No, this is gonna be an interesting back and forth, especially if Trump does what he says he's going to do. But here to share some thoughts on, you know, the email. I gotta be honest. You know, as I said, I am 100% on the side of a lot of this is corporate America's greed. A lot of this is bad policy by politicians, and a lot of it still us. As consumers, but here to share some thoughts, I've asked my good friend Scott Paul to come talk with us. Scott's the president of the Alliance for American Manufacturing, AmericanManufacturing.org, the website. Scott, thanks for taking time for us.
Hey, Rick, great to be with you.
So what do you make of Lewis's email? I mean, look, I don't think I've ever not said it's corporate America. I don't think I've ever not said intellectual property theft is the responsibility of corporate America, because we keep allowing the Chinese to steal, to cheat, to do all these things. I'm curious your thoughts.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, and I wish that there was like, it was like a either or thing, right? Like there was one choice or the other. And the truth is that it's, you know, kind of nuanced, right? I mean, does corporate America bear a lot of the blame for the outsourcing and the policy? Absolutely, they do. But it's not like the Chinese Communist Party was duped into this system. And this is the thing that I think is important for people to understand is that, first of all, the Chinese Communist Party makes decisions like this without consulting the people in China, right? There is no real elected government. There's no opportunity to change the government or to change flow. And what they have decided on, Rick, is a policy that would attract foreign investment, that would help build up their economy. And instead of kind of the old-fashioned way where you make some stuff, but you sell it to yourself and you get richer that way and you build up the middle class, you know, China's, in particular, Chinese Communist Party's philosophy as well as their policy has basically said, look, we're going to make our manufacturing economy bigger and we're going to do it at your expense. and we're going to steal intellectual property. We want to lead in these industries, and we want basically as full employment as we can possibly get in our manufacturing sector. We're going to make much more than we can possibly consume domestically. We want to dominate global competition. And this is literally in their documents. Okay. Right. This is like spelled out. And so it takes two, right? It's like there was a, you know, they want to become the world's greatest country and they want to dominate the United States. They don't want to have a geopolitical rival. And particularly like in what they think is their own sandbox, they don't want any rival at all. And in order to do that, they're willing to use economic means. Now, yes, corporate America, held out its hand for all of this because it saw dollar signs. And so there's no question that corporate America is complicit, but this is not a one-way street for blame. There is a lot of blame to go around here.
No, absolutely. And look, I'll be honest, if I'm China and I can get away with it, if I can steal your lunch money and there's no repercussion, I might do it. If I can grab your lunch off your tray and you're not going to do anything, this is where my position is we've been complicit in this for far too long. We've been too lax in this for far too long. And my rhetoric is about being a lot more muscular and protecting our own interests. I don't think this is out of bounds. And I've gotten a lot of feedback lately from people like Lewis who are saying you're too hard on China. And I'm going, I don't think so.
No, you're not. In fact, I'm not going to say you're too soft on China. I think you're just right on China, Rick. And I'll tell you why. Because, and again, yes, for the policy decisions that are made in the United States of America, first of all, there was a flawed philosophy, neoliberalism and free trade. There were leadership in both parties who played a role in this, and they were all greased by a lot of corporate money from corporations that standed to benefit greatly from all of this to increase their share prices. Okay, so yes, that is all true. But at the same time, the Chinese Communist Party has a couple of goals for China. They want to be the world's largest economy. They want to control the Asia Pacific region. They want to forcibly, if necessary, reunify, in their own words, Taiwan with China. And one of the ways they want to do this is to emasculate the United States' ability to project power in the Asia Pacific region. And part of that is military, but part of that is economic too. Yeah. Like if our capabilities are eroded, and our industrial capabilities are eroded, we would have no ability to keep up. Right now, China has the military capacity to quickly replace a lot of the stuff that would get consumed during wartime. The United States, on the other hand, not so much. We don't right now. And that's truly scary. And that is China. And again, our corporations, this wasn't their goal. This is not, I mean, Walmart was like, we want to make the United States weaker. No, that's not the goal of what Walmart wants to do. Walmart wants to make itself richer.
Right.
But China does want to make the United States weaker. The Chinese Communist Party does want to make the United States weaker. And so I think, yes, you're absolutely right for assigning some of the blame to the policies of the Chinese Communist Party.
But, you know, I've been seeing a lot of this, and Lewis goes into this in his email. Over the last several months, I've been seeing a lot of this kind of propaganda, you know, telling me how wonderful China is, how their healthcare system's better than ours, how their standard of living is better than ours. And you know, the rhetoric that I get, and look, I've never been to China, so I don't have a firsthand experience. And I got a question where Lewis was when he had his experience. But as I understand, and again, this is just my understanding, it's not the utopia that's been sold to me. It's a place where slave labor is being abused. It's a place where political thought and information is repressed. I mean, there's a lot of stuff here that I'm not comfortable with, but I also don't think it's the middle class utopia that's been sold.
No, it's certainly not. And yes, it is true that the Chinese economic policies lifted a lot of people out of poverty. into a better life. There is no question about that. But at the same time, those people cannot change their government. Number one, they cannot speak out against their government. Number two, number three, when things go south, they have no institutions they can lean on. And the healthcare experience for most Chinese people is far worse than you get in the United States. And look, we are far from a perfect system.
No, no.
You know that. I know that. I mean, you know, we're far from a perfect system, but I'd much rather, you know, get sick in the United States than in almost any place in China. And just here's the proof point about like what's kind of the better system. You know, how many people from anywhere in the world are clamoring to get into China to enjoy the benefits of being a citizen of China? The answer is zero or virtually zero. How many people want to come to the United States to make a better life for themselves and their family, or to seek an education, or to invent the next big thing, or to be a part of society where you can change your government? A lot of people.
Yep. So you clearly heard the end of my my segment.
Oh,
the question was, if it's so great, why are you here and not there? Yeah. Because clearly your experience here, and sadly so, and this is the experience of a lot of people here, especially a lot of our veterans, that, you know, healthcare is too hard to get. You know, there are a lot, there are problems. And if it is that utopia, you know, I questioned, why aren't you there? Because, well, clearly we've got problems here that you think are greater. Now, you know, from this point of view of China being able to dominate the world, which they're very open about, they're very honest about, they're saying they're going to do it. They write up plans saying they're going to do it. And EVs in the next generation of automobiles, that is the, you know, that's, they've already told us that's it. That's where they're going next. And, you know, we see all of this stuff about, you know, people wanting to allow them into this market, which would just decimate the U.S. auto market. So I'm curious your thoughts on what is a heavily subsidized industry in China, which is, you know, hell-bent on global domination. I wanted to get your thoughts.
Yeah. Yeah. And this is a big problem because, you know, the auto sector from a manufacturing perspective is the heartbeat of American manufacturing. And you think about all the other industries that are impacted, whether it's steel, aluminum, tires, glass, you know, rubber, semiconductors, electronics, all the auto parts companies. I mean, all the stuff that goes into an automobile, that is a big chunk of manufacturing in the United States. And so, and our know-how. And so the problem is that these Chinese EV companies started up, and they got a massive amount of government subsidies, way more on a scale than we've ever even talked about here doing. And they had a protected market and they extended out. And the challenge now is that they'd like to break into the U.S. market because we buy, you know, 15, 16 million cars a year. I mean, we're a game changer for anybody. And our companies, you know, don't have the same cost of capital as the companies in China do. And yeah, I think it's fair to say that the Chinese tech in these EVs is pretty advanced. There's no question about that. Now, a lot of that was derived from joint ventures with Western companies. Some of it was derived from intellectual property theft. Some of it was derived from joint research with the military. But I mean, here we are. And it would be an enormous mistake. It's like Trojan horse proportion level stupidity to allow Chinese EVs in the United States right now, because it would wipe out our car companies. It would wipe out those auto jobs. And at the end of the day, we all want to get to a place where if people want to buy an EV, they should be able to do that and also view it as part of the transition to cleaner forms of energy eventually. But we cannot do that and have it be China-centric. That would be an enormous, enormous mistake, because if we all thought the job losses in manufacturing were bad in the 70s and the 80s and the 90s and the aughts, man, it's nothing compared to what would happen if those Chinese vehicles were allowed to come into the U.S. market at scale.
Now, I was going to ask, because, you know, if you lose the auto industry, you know, What does that do, not just for the jobs and the communities, but what does it do for our national security? Because ultimately, you know, Lewis, a disabled Marine Corps veteran, Vietnam veteran era, you know, this has got to be something that he's got to be thinking about as well. What does this do if we decimate the auto industry in this country? Because China has been very clear they want to dominate the global auto industry. What does that mean for our national security?
Yeah, it means a lot. I do want to say that I can completely understand why Lewis probably feels undervalued by our nation and by the government for all the stuff that Vietnam vets have had to endure for the last, you know, the last four or five decades. And also, truthfully, for the state of like VA healthcare, you know, somewhat. I mean, it could be dramatically improved, right? And so I think he comes at this from a place of probably very justifiable frustration. But to your point, you know, he and other generations of soldiers, we've always been able to lean on the commercial side of our industry to scale up at a time of need. And the challenge, particularly if a lot of auto plants go away, just as a lot of steel plants have and a lot of shipyards have, is that, you know, we during wartime, we were able to convert all of that very quickly to military supply. Now, you're going to have a much harder time trying to convert a Walmart or an Amazon warehouse or a McDonald's into something that's going to help our military in some way. I mean, it's impossible to do that. I'm being kind of sarcastic, you know, but it's impossible to do that. And that's one reason why you want to maintain a very healthy manufacturing base and to have that capacity, because, you know, that is the, you know, that's how we did the arsenal of democracy and won World War II. It wasn't a secret, but that's exactly how we did it, Rick.
Yeah. No, and look, I'm not beating up on Lewis, and I don't want him or anyone else to think that I am, because I understand the anger. The anger is real, and I think it has to be respected. And, you know, Democrats, Republicans, independents, policymakers have got to think that, look, there are a lot of people in our society who are struggling. You know, right here. Everyone's having a hard time making ends meet. Everyone's having a difficult time with healthcare, with education spending down the road. And for me, these conversations, especially about China and jobs and manufacturing, I think are at the heart of what could pull us together as opposed to ripping us apart. And it's the reason that I chose this particular email to talk about, because I think it encompasses a lot of that anger and then that want for better. Does that make sense?
It totally makes sense. And there's again, I think Lewis raises a lot of great points, but part of the solution, and I believe this very, very profoundly, is not to emulate stuff that China's doing, right? I mean, that's not what part of the solution, is. And to be very honest about what the intent of China's government is. And it's not good. No. I mean, that's the bottom line. It's not good to most of its own people, okay? Particularly if they disagree with the government or if they're the quote unquote wrong religion, right? You know, like if you happen to be a Muslim Uyghur, you happen to be a Tibetan Buddhist, life's not very good for you.
Yeah.
In China. And so that's not right.
So last question I've got for you, since we've been talking about EVs and talking about China wanting to dominate the global electric vehicle market, there's going to be a changeover in your neck of the woods in D.C. on January 20th. There's going to be a massive policy shift. Are we already ceding the manufacturing of EVs and the next generation of vehicles to China by maybe not continuing the policies, because we've heard they're going to reverse a lot of those policies? Do you get a sense of where this could be going? Do you get a sense of if we're already losing the market? Any thoughts?
Yeah, that is a great question. And so I do think that we're far enough along that EVs have a foothold in the United States. And again, even if an EV isn't for you now, it may be in 10, 20, 30 years when they're more accessible, there's more charging, and there's better life and the price, or better battery life and the price comes down. They aren't right for everybody right now. Let's be very clear. But fundamentally, what I want to see and I want to make sure of is that those things are made in the United States, right? And that we're not at a point where we've given up on the industry, and all those, like the Rivian goes away, and the factories that are just starting up goes away, and then we're bringing all that stuff in from China, because that would be what exactly would happen. Huge mistake. We got to keep the tariffs on Chinese EVs. We got to crack down on any Chinese EVs coming up from Mexico, if that were to happen. And we have to at least be neutral when it comes to EVs, and internal combustion engines as we move ahead, and find ways to build out that charging network. Because once that's done, I think it'll be much more attractive to more folks here.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I remember a time when we, as a country, we were always pushing the bounds of possible and looking to the future with technology and with different abilities. And I'm a little concerned at this point. But Scott, as always, I appreciate the time, the thoughts. Great stuff. Look forward to talking to you again real soon.
Rick, thanks so much for having me on. Really appreciate it.
Our good friend Scott Paul, president of the Alliance for American Manufacturing. Want to hear your thoughts? Email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com. Do you agree with Lewis that it could be a utopia over there and maybe we're on the wrong path? Or I guess, which side are you on? rick@therickSmithShow.com. Right back.
This is the Buzz of the North, 910 AM WBZH. Your news, conversations, and a whole lot of fun. It's all on your local Civic Media radio station or the Civic Media app.
I'm meteorologist Mace Michaels. Cloudy tonight with flurries and snow showers fluffing up to a dusting to an inch. Temps drop into the single digits tonight and stay there tomorrow as the wind picks up, dropping wind chills well below zero as the sky clears. Much colder for Wednesday night and Thursday. Currently, it's 19 degrees.
Matt Nair on air. This shouldn't be a thing.
Michigan man leads lawnmower chase. I'll stop, says the suspect. Instead, he reaches under the seat and pulls out a gun.
Shoots himself in the hand.
The deputy has his taser trained on him, and yes, he tased him.
I'm not advocating for crime, but boost something that goes faster than cop on foot.
Matt Nair on air. Weekdays 10 till noon on your local Civic Media radio station and on the app.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
The Rick Smith Show. Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So they finally found the shooter of the CEO in Manhattan, the United Healthcare Group CEO, Brian Thompson. They found the shooter, 26-year-old. Not quite what I think everyone was expecting. 28-year-old with a college degree, a master's degree from the University of Penn, a valedictorian of a very high-cost private school as a high school student from a wealthy family, has a relative who's a delegate in the Maryland House. There's a lot here. All in all, somebody who, a bright guy, bright kid, smart, good grades, good, engineer, you'd go, lots going on, lots of opportunity, lots of a future. And as I said, look, I believed that the person who did this, would inevitably be somebody, and this is not a very far leap. It doesn't take a rocket scientist to figure it out. But someone who felt wronged by the healthcare industry. And I believe once we find the manifesto, if they release that, and I am going to assume it will get released fairly soon, if not by the defense attorneys, by somebody. Because ultimately, this is going to be the trial down the road is going to be, can you get people on the jury who are going to convict? Because what's interesting, and this is where I'm at on a certain level as well. The reality is the reason people were rooting for this guy to get away, the reason that they were and the reason that I was a lot more tolerant, is because look, for many in our society, justice isn't possible. Our system is not set up to ensure that the little guy ever gets justice. And that you get these big corporate executives, these big powerful entities, who basically steamroll over the lives of average, everyday people. And I understand it, and I've talked about this extensively, especially in communications, off the show. This idea that, let me be very clear, I am not condoning violence in any way, shape, or form. But I understand it. And this is where the difference is. To say that we can never, never have violence, I think is a bit of a stretch. Because sometimes there is no other avenue. What are wars? So this idea that we're going to take this moral high ground, we find out that this kid spent time, through high school working in an assisted living community. We find out that his grandmother and grandfather passed. There's some reporting saying that there were some things that were, this person felt wrong, has his own medical issues, and it's believed that the insurance companies had something to do with it. There's going to be, I believe, a direct link to the United Healthcare Group. There's going to be a link to the policies. And out of this, and what I want to see out of this, what I want to see out of this tragedy, out of this horrible situation, and it is, because a father, a husband, an American lost their life needlessly. A young man who had a bright future, his life is basically over. I wish that I could make some sense out of this, other than to say, I hope it leads to us waking up to a system that is badly broken. And our healthcare system is badly broken. The insurance companies have so much leverage and so much power, and these hospitals are run, sadly, by bean counters and not so much by people who are patient-centric. I know we hear it all the time. Well, we care about the patient. No, I don't know. I'm not buying that as much. Now that we've consolidated into these big corporate entities that have flow charts and policy absolutes. And understand, as a number of people have pointed out, that's just your grief speaking, Rick. No, I actually believe that there are some points. If I'm sitting on a jury and someone is in this situation, there are moments where I may not convict. As all of us could potentially be convinced of. So what I'm waiting to see, and there will be more that drips and drabs out of this. We're going to find all of the things that he's written. We're going to find all of the things that he's liked on social media. One of those things I saw is he said that the guy gave a 4-star review of the Unabomber's manifesto. He wrote on this saying, when all other forms of communications fail, violence is necessary to survive. You may not like his methods, but to see things from his perspective, it's not terrorism, it's war and revolution. And understand, there's a lot of that rhetoric going around right now. Obviously, for me, this kid being kind of a libertarian, kind of a tech bro, kind of not the hippie liberal that I'm sure the right wanted it to be. It's going to be interesting to see how they respond to this. But for me, it's not about the media lobbying and the media back and forth as about the policy. Could this tragedy, could this save lives? Is this something that could change policies? Understand, United Healthcare Group has a 32% denial rate. People die from those policies. And there's a lot of memes on social media of, what's the difference between the two. And I don't condone either. But for us, we the people, my fear is that the anger is getting out of control. And yes, this could spike and spiral into more violence. And I don't want to see that. I have friends who are the Red Hat Brigade, who are, you know, preparing every day because they believe, you know, the next civil war is coming, war and revolution. And they're preparing rice and guns buried all over the neighborhood, because they believe that this is the answer. And ultimately, you know, it's the American story. You know, the American Revolution was part of that. I hope, and this is where I keep coming back to, because I think this is where I wanna spend a lot of time into. We've got bad policies. We've got bad systems. And it's in those systems, it's in those structures, it's in those policies that people are left to languish, and where people who are cheering for this person to have gotten away, where they know someone. I can't tell you how many emails I've gotten over the last couple of days. Look, I've gotten a couple from people going, "Oh, you're wrong. I'm never going to talk to you again." And okay, I get that. But the vast majority are people who are like, "You know, I'm with you, Rick. I don't condone it. I don't like it. Don't want it. Don't want to see violence. Don't want to see bloodshed. Don't want to see pain and suffering and misery. Don't want to see it. But I also don't want to be the recipient of it. I also don't want to be the one on the receiving end of the pain and the suffering, because I can't get the care I need when I need it. My loved one can't get the care that they need when they need it." And this is a policy. This is a policy thing. And this is where my problem with the Trump administration is. And yes, I'm going to take it back to Donald Trump's first term and the people that he put on the Supreme Court. And the fact that we have a party in this country hell-bent on deregulation. That we're just going to take the gloves off. Let corporate America do whatever it is corporate America wants to do. Let the insurance companies do everything that their little heart could ever desire. Because understand, one of the things that the Trump folks are going to do is they're going to try and gut the ACA. They are going to try to cut what progress we've made in healthcare in my lifetime. We're going to try and go backwards. Back to the good old days of pay or die. Back to the good old days of absolute caps. I'm in a situation personally where if it weren't for the ACA, and I have incredible health care, and thank you to my Teamsters Union for negotiating the best health care that is possibly out there. But they had caps. $1 million. Boom. That was it. You hit $1 million. Sorry. You're gonna have to declare bankruptcy and hit Medicaid. Find another job. Get another insurance policy. Good luck finding someone who will take you. It's a pre-existing condition. Sorry, buddy. You're on your own. Considering that my wife right now, with her injuries and having going through this tragedy that we're going through, is easily over $1.5 million in medical costs right now. That's remarkable to me. And where my mind takes me is, as we see this stuff being taken from us, the anger is only going to get worse. Because as we talked about at the beginning of the show, I believe Lewis's anger is real. I believe that the voters' anger is real. I believe when people tell me that they're struggling to make ends meet, that life isn't what they were told it was going to be, I believe them. I understand. I'm there. You know, we were told as kids, you work hard, you play by the rules, you're going to get ahead. You're going to succeed. Our birthright was doing better than our parents, and a lot of people aren't living up to that. And there's a lot of reason for it. But again, I come back to this anger. If we're not talking about the source of that anger, if we're not talking about how do we tap that down? How do we fix these systems that are wrong, that are broken? If we're not going to do that, then expect more of this stuff to happen. We always talk about the pitchforks coming out. Well, we don't use pitchforks in this country anymore. It's guns, and we got lots of them. And in fact, in this case, the kid printed his own gun, which get ready for a ban very soon on ghost guns. Now, for me, what's interesting is the police response. I know people who have had, who have been victims of crime, who nobody was caught. There's still open cases, still cold cases, still, you know, maybe somebody's still looking. All hands were on deck here because of who it was. And for me, that's a problem as well. The fact that, you know, this one guy, all of this media attention, all of this resource of police force, you know, $50,000, I think, from the FBI, $10,000 from, I think, the city of New York, lots of money being thrown at it. Working class people who suffer a loss like this, where someone's, you know, murdered or mugged, or you don't get this kind of response. Which, again, I come back to. This is kind of why I think a lot of people were rooting for this kid to get away. But the New York Police Department spokesman said, it seems he had some ill will towards corporate America. You think? Or do you think it had a lot to do with ailing relatives? You think it had a lot to do with the fact that he saw things happen to people in assisted living facilities? Do you think something had something to do with it? So it's going to be interesting to me to see how this plays out, because this kid doesn't fit into that right-left frame. There's none of that bright kid, wealthy family, all that. We'll see. Now, as I said, and I want to reiterate this and make it crystal clear. I am not justifying murder. I am not justifying it. I am not condoning it. So please don't tell me, oh, you're encouraging it and you're responsible. I'm not. I'm simply telling you that I understand it. And I'll tell you, I am looking forward to reading what this person, what was in his mind. Because we're going to hear a lot about his mental state in the coming days, weeks, and months, or at least I think we are. Want to hear your thoughts? Email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com. Going to take a quick break. Right back after this. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1855. That was the day that Haymarket martyr August Spies was born. He immigrated to America from Germany in 1872 and became involved in the Chicago labor movement while working as an upholsterer. The Panic of 1873 and the Great Strikes of 1877 radicalized Spies. He soon joined the Socialist Labor Party, but left over the issue of electoral politics. He and others favored revolutionary action instead and threw their weight to the emerging anarcho-syndicalist movement. Spies and his comrade, Albert Parson, believed trade unions must work towards ending capitalism rather than simply fighting for economic gains. They soon became leaders of the International Working People's Association in Chicago. Spies became the editor of the radical German language newspaper, Arbeiter Zeitung. The workers' newspaper decried the incredible wealth of a few amidst the immense poverty and suffering workers faced. It became a rallying point for the 8-hour day campaign. Spies and other anarchist leaders, who would soon be known as the Haymarket Martyrs, became involved in organizing the May Day strike in 1886. Spies gave the impassioned speech at the McCormick Reaper Works. He witnessed the Chicago police shoot down two workers as they confronted scabs at the gate and organized a protest rally in response. The rally took place at the Haymarket Square the next evening. When the fateful bomb was thrown, Spies and his comrades were immediately arrested. They were tried and convicted for their political views. There was no evidence linking any of them to any crime. As he walked to the gallows, Spies shouted, "The day will come when our silence will be more powerful than the voices you are throttling today."
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
So I had an interesting conversation with a friend. Asked me who I thought the DNC chair would be. And we had a fairly spirited back and forth, because he's a fairly progressive guy. He's got his thought. He wants to see Martin O'Malley as the governor. And I'm like, former governor of Maryland, former, I guess he's the Social Security Administrator now. But he wants Martin O'Malley to be the DNC chair. And I'm like, maybe. Okay. You know, Ken Martin, the Democratic chair in Minnesota, DNC vice chair. His name's been thrown around a bunch. James Skofas, New York State Senator, his name's been thrown around. And Ben Winkler, Wickler, his name is. I always get that wrong. Winkler, I always say. He's the chair of the Wisconsin Democratic Party. And look, the good thing is if Ben gets it, we can certainly expect the DNC to continue to ignore us, as Jamie Harrison did. Because we reached out to him at the very beginning of his term and said, hey, you know, look, we want to get people to come on. We want to grill your spokespeople. And, well, he started his own podcast. So that's where we want. Now, here's the thing. Any of those guys, I think, will be okay. None of them light my fire. But if it's Rahm Emanuel, if they choose Rahm Emanuel, who has said he's not interested, but, yeah, we'll see. If it is Rahm Emanuel, I will be changing my registration to independent. I will not be part of a party going back to neoliberalism. That will not happen. So choose wisely, DNC. And look, who I would like to see, and again, I come back to the Democratic Party has got to find their roots again. They've got to find their working class roots. And for me, nobody does that better than Sherrod Brown or John Tester. I know, two old white guys. Yeah, two very, very progressive working class voices. Two people who clearly understand what the party needs to be doing. So not that either of them would take it. Understand, I don't believe Sherrod or John Tester are going to take it. I think John Tester is going to go back to his ranch. I believe he's going to, you know, live out his time enjoying life out of Washington, D.C., out of the headaches, going, yeah, you kicked me one last time. But I think Sherrod may run for either governor or for Senate next time around. And look, I would love to see Sherrod back in the Senate. I wouldn't mind seeing him as a governor either, but it's the message that comes out of this. And I'm a big messaging person. I think you need to have someone who's going to find that unifying message, that thing that pulls us together instead of apart. And what the Democratic Party has done masterfully over the last several years is they've siloed themselves. Not that several years. We've been doing this for a while. We've siloed ourselves out. You're over here, you're over there, you over there, and nobody talks. Oh, sure, we talk at each other all the time. And we talk about tolerance, and yet a lot of groups are fairly intolerant. And I think by having, you know, blue-collar rooted leadership, I think that's the way forward. Put me as the head of the DNC. Let's talk about how we can go back to working class values. Talk about what really matters to people. Or do we not know? And that's. I was having a conversation with a friend today, and he said, look, you know, I know a working class immigrant in Las Vegas, and I know this billionaire, spouse, who both said the same thing about Kamala Harris's campaign. And they both said, who in the heck cares about Beyonce? You know, while people are struggling to put food on their table, while rents are through the roof, while there is real pain and suffering, you know, why are you touting, you know, these entertainers? Why are you courting them? Why are you putting them out in front? Why aren't we talking about meat and potatoes, bread and butter kind of issues? And it's what we've been saying on this show for a very long time. Where the rubber meets the road is where we need to be focusing our attention. Making sure those roads don't have potholes. Making sure that gas prices are affordable. Public transportation. We should be investing in making lives better. And the messaging had better be this way. Whoever the next DNC chair is had better start thinking about how you're going to message to working class voters. Because understand, if you had true working class solidarity, and I argue somewhere in the 60% range of Americans are working class. That means you go, you punch a clock, you collect a paycheck, and that paycheck does not go as far as it used to. And guess what? If you lose that job, chances are your life gets worse. because it's going to be hard to find another job in those conditions that you've got. Now, I have a lot of people that say, oh, I find a job tomorrow. Then why aren't you? So for me, whoever the next DNC chair is, you got a lot of work and a lot of groundwork. One of the knocks I've always had against my labor friends is we ramp up a couple of months before an election, go out there knocking on doors, motivating, rallies, all that stuff. And then the other 10 months of the year, and then the 12 months of the next year, we nothing. There's got to be a constant communication. You know, I've heard some people like Ellie Mistal coming out and saying, well, we need a Joe Rogan. No, we don't need a Joe Rogan. We need constant engagement. We need people who are going to be able to find voices they identify with. One of the things that I've been saying for years, and I'm going to continue to say it, is the working class people that I know seek out voices that they recognize, that understand what it's like to walk a mile in their shoes. That is universal. That never changes. And Democrats haven't given people that voice. There hasn't been an infrastructure built to speak to, well, everyone the way the right has built it. And until they're able to connect, their policies aren't going to matter. You're talking foreign languages, because most people, this is part of the reason I started this show, is that politicians would come into our union hall and make all of these grand promises. Oh, we're going to pass the Employee Free Choice Act. We're going to get the PRO Act. We're going to do all this. We're going to save Medicare. What I've come to realize, and what I came to realize in 2005, is they didn't do any of that stuff because they couldn't. And all of the fights that we've been fighting as working class people over the years, we've lost. And the reason that the working class is so angry is we continue to lose. Because understand, government decides who gets what. And a government funded by billionaires, a government now going to be run by billionaires, is going to cater to, fill in the blank, billionaires. So are we shocked that our needs are not even considered? We get some Madison Avenue think tank jargon, some focus group tested think tank approved jargon that they repeat ad nauseum on Fox and on AOAN and the NON and the POQ and all of the other places that they have to continue to pump the propaganda. Because they get that people are angry and they're channeling that anger. And sadly, I would argue they're channeling that anger against working people. There's a reason that Social Security is in trouble. It's because our policymakers haven't done the things that need to be done to fix it. There's a reason Medicare is going to be privatized because, well, the moneyed interests want it. I don't know very many people who are thrilled with the privatized version of Medicare. They get a couple of little sweeteners. They get to negotiate for drug prices. Why didn't we let Medicare negotiate for drug prices? Oh, yeah, because we were going to kill it. So over these next 4 years, and the next two for certain, pay attention to what they're doing. Don't listen to what they're saying. The rhetoric, the tweeting, the propaganda that's coming out of your speakers, I wouldn't buy a bit of it. Watch what they're doing to us. Watch the things that they're deregulating, the power shift that's happening, the continued privatization of our healthcare and our Medicare systems, the deregulation of corporate America over our lives and what they put into our food and our water and our air, what they're literally doing to us every single day to squeeze the quarter a little bit tighter to make that eagle scream. To put more profit in their pocket and, well, less days in your life. So over especially this next year or two, there is a lot to be paying attention to, and I want to hear from you. I want to hear what your thoughts are. Have I gone too far? Did I miss something here? email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com, because look, I'm concerned where we're going to end up with at the end of the next couple years. I'm concerned what this country looks like when we give the billionaire class unfettered control and access to our government. We should be paying attention. Again, email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Want to hear your thoughts. Miss any portion of the program, make sure you grab the podcast. Wherever you get your favorite podcast, you'll find ours. And as always, thanks so much for being here. We'll see you back here next time.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Email Rick. Rick@thericksmithshow.com. This is the Buzz of the North. WBZH 910 AM, W245 CT Hayward, and always streaming on the Civic Media app.
ABC News, I'm Richard Cantu. A federal judge in Portland, Oregon has temporarily put the kibosh on the proposed $24 billion merger of Albertsons and Kroger supermarket chains.
Federal Judge Adrienne Nelson sided with the Federal Trade Commission, which argued that the deal would cut competition and potentially raise prices. The FTC wanted a delay so it could do its own in-house review of the implications. The judge rejected the company's counterargument that selling over 500 stores would replace lost competition.
ABC's Chuck Sievertson. Preliminary numbers from Malibu, California, where a wildfire has burned almost or more than 3,000 acres at this point, destroying seven structures, including homes, and damaging eight more. South Korean authorities arrested the National Police Commissioner and the police chief of Seoul, part of the investigation into the quickly reversed declaration of martial law last week. The former defense minister was arrested on Tuesday night and has reportedly tried to commit suicide. This is ABC News.